Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dr. MC's Self-Care Cabaret Podcast. I'm Teresa Melito Connors, a doctoral-level educational administrator and mental health practitioner focused on helping you, our world's helpers. Every day, we have a choice to prioritize our well-being, to incorporate reflection, recovery, renewal, and resilience strategies into our lives. However, those of us who step up and serve our communities in healthcare, education, nonprofit spaces, and more can struggle with putting ourselves first. I've seen this firsthand. It's a challenge. Enter Dr. MC's Self-Care Cabaret Podcast. Here, we have real, intimate conversations with leading experts passionate about accessible, sustainable self-care in its 10 domains. It's all about the hard work we can take on together to find our spotlight. So before we dive into today's guest, which I'm super excited about, I just want to highlight the environmental domain for just a moment. It's one of the 10. And if you've been following along, we do talk about this domain frequently. But we recently had a small home renovation project that quickly mushroomed a little bit out of control, as they often do. You start fixing one thing and then 10 other things pop up that you think, oh, wow, we should take care of that right now. Anyway, all of that to say, this has been really impacting my well-being over the last couple of weeks. Just seeing my house covered in a thin layer of dust, despite hanging any of those, you know, plastic curtains and all that good stuff, and just having just my space disrupted. So just want to give you a friendly reminder that that is very real. So if your space is disordered and chaotic and cluttered, it's going to impact your well-being. Now, thankfully, in my situation, it's temporary, and my husband and I will get it all cleaned up and better than ever, and it'll be a distant memory soon. But when you're in it, it's really hard. So reminding yourself of those things and really making sure that you're just maintaining your spaces. And this applies to your home, your office, your classroom, even your car. That plays a factor, all of the energy in those spaces on your well-being. So if you're feeling like things are energetically off or it's causing you stress when you're in certain spaces, see what you can do. If you can do some little things to just clean things up or change a space or get rid of something that's no longer bringing you joy and donate things, get rid of them, sell them, whatever you want to do. Because it's really important to maintain that environmental domain. Your brain can't tell the difference when things are chaotic and crazy. It thinks that there's more work to do. So it's hard for you to relax when you're in a space like that. So there's your friendly reminder for today. And now today's guest is Jess Springle. Jess owns and operates a private practice specializing in the care and treatment of adolescents, young adults, adults, and families impacted by eating disorders, disordered eating, body image disturbances, and adjacent issues. She is a champion of freedom, justice, and liberation for all people and all bodies and practices from an intersectional, social justice-aligned lens. Jess considers herself to be a radically genuine therapist and seeks to embody authenticity and humanness with clients. They bring this to the social media world through their Instagram account at The Cranky Therapist, which is a super popular account and one of my favorites, and Twitter at Jess Springle, SprengleLPC on Twitter. And without further delay, here is our conversation. Right, Jess, the cranky therapist. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It never gets old for people to call me that. It is always fun.
It is. It's a great handle. I love it. And we'll learn maybe a little bit more about that later in the interview. But first, the way I like to start all my interviews is by asking, how do you like to practice self-care?
Oh, always such a good question, and one that therapists get a lot. I mean, I think self-care has been really challenging, I think, since I became a therapist really young. So by the time I was like in my career and settled, I was like, what do I like to do? I don't even know who I am as a human. So it's been really fun to be able to explore hobbies and figure out like, what do I like to do? So different things that I've like kind of learned along the way. Just a lot of my self-care time is like very introspective and quiet. So it's like reading, journaling, and just really like centering myself and being alone, which I'm a huge extrovert. So that's kind of odd that it so happens that way. But I just really like my me time. And I'm also a huge proponent of therapists and therapy. So I go to therapy. I love my therapist so dearly. And it is the best time I could really have as a human. I think it's just so essential to my self-care. Essential really to me being a good provider, honestly. So that's a huge, huge component of it.
I love that. Yeah. Being okay with being alone and like, just sometimes you need that space. Like, I think that's a great tip. And yes, I also love my therapist too. It is really important just to have like that person, that outlet, and being able to get that support in that kind of relationship domain for someone to have that. I always recommend that to folks if they don't work with anybody, or if they're feeling like they don't have a strong support system, or just aren't feeling heard or respected in their relationships, so like they could benefit from working with someone.
Makes a huge difference. I obviously, like, therapy can be difficult to access for a lot of folks. Sure. And I definitely want to name that. But I didn't have access to care for a good chunk of time, big chunks of time in my life, and until I was like really an adult. So I'm super excited that I have the therapist I have and have been able to see her for several years. She's a gem. So I feel really lucky.
That's awesome. So how do you like respond to someone who's maybe resistant to trying therapy, or resistant to even just the whole idea? Like, as a therapist, how do you respond to that?
It's interesting that I actually do not have a lot of contact with folks who are not like on the more therapy positive side of things, except like, you know, through not so nice people on the internet. I think just being a therapist, I'm surrounded by a lot of other therapists, and most people in my life are very pro therapy.
So that's good.
but yes, I feel like I've cultivated that pretty well for myself. But of course, like, there are so many people out there who still have a lot of outdated ideas about what therapy is, who it's for. And I know, like, my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, like, you didn't go to therapy unless you were quote unquote crazy. And I mean, even when I was growing up, like when I was a teenager in like the early 2000s, therapy was not super like accepted. It wasn't looked at as like this great thing. It was definitely more of a like, oh yeah, if you have something wrong with you, then you go to therapy. So anytime I do come into contact with people who are like maybe not super excited about therapy, it's usually around that where it's like, well, I don't have anything wrong with me, so why would I go to therapy? It's like, well, like, you can go to therapy for really any reason. It could be proactive. I mean, I don't know why we really don't look at therapy as a preventative measure at all in the United States, for whatever reason. But I think that would be something that's usually something I try to remind people of. It's like, you might have some different ideas about therapy than what it actually is. So I usually, sometimes unsuccessfully, try to use that time to, like, if the person allows me to, allow them to ask questions or like take some time to educate them around like what therapy actually is, because I think most people really don't know.
So how would you describe what therapy really is?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, and this is honestly what I thought therapy was before I was a therapist. It's like, well, there is like this expert in the room, and like, they are judging you and like thinking about all the things that you have screwed up and done wrong, and just like this very like critical punitive lens. And now as a therapist, I'm like, oh, that's hilarious. Because I know that for me, like, I cannot say I've ever sat in judgment of a client. Honestly, I think just the relationship between client and therapist is, to me, what like real therapy is defined by, where it's like, you have this other person in the room who sees you for who you are and is not sitting in judgment of you, really cares about you, loves you, probably. It's more of a collaborative experience. It's more of a, like, I don't want to say peer, because I think there's just like an inherent power dynamic sometimes in therapy. But I mean, I certainly look at my clients as the experts in the room because they are the experts of them. I'm certainly not an expert on their entire life before they come to see me. So I always try to sell therapy in that way, where it's like, this is just an opportunity for you to have a relationship with someone where they're not trying to take from you. No. Like, they're just there for you, really, to be a resource. Also to probably call you out on your sometimes, but largely it's a kind of a less partial third party.
Yeah. Oh, and I love that you just highlight the importance of the relationship, because that's really what a huge piece of it is. And I can remember too, like, just thinking back, like in my late teen years, early 20s, I really struggled with different things. I was in an abusive relationship. My parents had gotten divorced. And although that relationship with my parents was never good, it still was a loss and a very big transition to now be with my mom on our own. Sure. And her struggles of now, you know, navigating life as a single mom, and just like all. And I remember one time her suggesting back then that I go to therapy, and I remember being like, what? No, I don't think so. Like, because I had that kind of thought of like the stereotypical, like, well, there's nothing wrong with me. What do you mean I need to go to therapy? And she was like, I just think you got like some stuff to work through. And I didn't go at that time. But funny thing, I then decided, you know, let's, you know, finish undergrad. And then I found myself kind of working with kids and was like, I want to do a master's in school counseling. And although I'm not a formal therapist, a school counseling master's degree is essentially, it's all psych based. It's all psychology. We had to do counseling classes and clinical and like all kinds of stuff. And like everything, I was basically like getting therapy while being, while learning to be a counselor. And it was just life changing. And, you know, kind of after that, it was like, oh yeah, no, that's what it's supposed to be about. Now I understand. And then, you know, obviously years later, getting into therapy myself as a client has certainly been helpful for many different reasons. And I love the idea of it being preventative. I think that's really key.
Yeah. I think in particular, like with my specialty, because I specialize in eating disorders, I think it would be so hugely impactful if we did focus more on preventative care, because there are so many young people who do develop eating disorders, and thinking about like that could be caught. Yeah. Even if, you know, just like, I think back to my own experience as a kid, and I was just very sensitive and very precocious. And I think about like what my life would have been like if I had just had like a different adult around who had just been like, yeah, all right, talk to me about like whatever. What TV show are you watching? Like, you know, it wouldn't have to be anything like super therapy, quote unquote, centered so much as just, okay, there is this like safe adult who's listening to me.
Yeah.
And it isn't necessarily like charged with anything. Hopefully. I can't definitely want to name that therapists are not, we are not a monolith and not all of us are great.
Sure. Fair enough.
Plenty of not great therapists out there, but it is just a nice thought to consider, like, if kids had like a safe adult, like what would that look like? And especially so far as like food and body is concerned, that would be a very different world.
It would be amazing. Yeah. So can you tell, you've mentioned a little bit, like as a therapist, you specialize in eating disorders. And I know I said a little in your intro, but can you talk a little bit more? Because I feel like your work kind of covers a lot of ground and you got kind of a lot of different things going on. At least that's the impression I get.
Yeah. You know, I think during the pandemic, I was feeling a little burnt out. So I was just figuring out how to pivot around a little bit. So that's, I think, why I have my hands in some more things than I used to. But for the most part, I'm an individual one-to-one therapist. I see, I used to exclusively see adolescents, but now I mostly see like older adolescents, young adults, and with most of the time they have eating disorders, usually identify as LGBTQ, and or may have some form of neurodivergence, which is ADHD, autism, dyslexia, fill in the blank. There are a number of different things that fall under that umbrella. So I have a really nice little niche for myself.
Yeah, no, you really do. It's really important.
It's, and I didn't really aim, honestly, to like fall into that. I think that was more of a, like an accident. I do work with a lot of queer and trans folks and always have. It's just a passion of mine. And then I think just there are a lot of people who are neurodivergent who have eating disorders. So I think there's just like this really unique intersection and a lot of neurodivergent people who are queer or trans. So it's just a, I don't know, it's a really fun bunch of people. I adore my clients. Couldn't say enough good things. And I really feel really lucky to do the work that I do. And that accounts for, I would say, like a good, probably about 80 to 90% of my work as a provider. And the other thing that I started doing during the pandemic was I started doing a lot more consultation with other therapists who maybe wanted to learn how to be a better eating disorder provider, or just like learn anything about eating disorders at all, because in school we quite literally do not learn very much. You know, maybe you get a slide or two,
maybe
if you're lucky. I know at least in my counseling program there was like maybe one or two slides, and that was the extent of the eating disorder education. And
meanwhile,
my poor cohort they learned a lot from me against their will. But it's just, it is a sad reality that there's just not a whole lot of education considering the population of people who struggle. Yeah. It's just bizarre. So that is definitely a passion of mine, like being an educator and making sure that people have a space to learn and ask questions, because it's just, the eating disorder field can be a little cutthroat sometimes. And because I think we feel very protective of each other and our clients, and a lot of people get it wrong and say things to our clients that are horrible and misguided. So I think it can be difficult if someone who is like not part of the field is asking a question that's viewed as like a stupid question. Whereas I really try to cultivate that space with my consultation group of, there is no such thing as a stupid question. Like, you have, this is your time. You get to ask me whatever you want. And it's been a really like fulfilling aspect of my work. Really has helped me remember how long I've been doing this work and how much information I have somehow in this brain. Because I've been doing this for almost a decade.
Awesome.
And just, yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, I mean, the field has changed a lot. So it's nice to be able to contribute to people's education. It feels good.
Yeah, well, that's really beautiful. Thank you for the work that you do. I'm in recovery for multiple eating disorders. And I was creeping on your website, and I think, are you also in recovery? Did I see an...
Yes,
I thought so. And you don't have to talk more about that if you don't want to. I was looking at things on your website, and I'm like, oh, interesting. And so I'm wondering, you know, if you're willing to share, like, what was kind of one, because like I know what I would say, but what is one like major lesson that like from your own recovery that you kind of learn that you carry with you into your work? Because you work with a lot of folks that have similar lived experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. I never have any problem talking about it. I think it's just, I kind of like at this point, I'm like, okay, like it's part of who I am.
That happened.
You know, part of my history. Yeah. It's like, okay. But God, how many things have I learned? My recovery has been a pretty incredible teacher, and sometimes lots of lessons I did not want to learn. But I think like so far as what I bring to my work is, interestingly, I think, you know, eating disorders are so isolating. I spent a lot of my adolescence feeling really alone and not having anybody that I really felt understood what I was experiencing. And, you know, that wasn't great. 0 out of 10.
I do not recommend.
And ultimately, like as I was an older adolescent, almost college age, I did go to treatment, and there was just this different world that opened up for me, where it was like, oh, like there are a lot of people who struggle, and there are so many people who are not people I would have expected to struggle. You know, as a teenager, you have a lot of like very small-minded thoughts about everything, but just even, you know, going to treatment, seeing boys and men in treatment, and we're just being around so many people who I was like, oh, we all have this similar lived experience, but that doesn't mean that we're all the same. And it absolutely doesn't mean that like what's going to work for me is going to work for them and vice versa. And that was an incredible learning opportunity for me of, oh, like, even though like treatment is really impactful and can be really useful, it's not actually considering sometimes that there is no universal treatment. Like there is just no standard, like we're all very different. And I try to remember that and bring that to my work because, yeah, I mean, if I've seen, God, like 500 plus clients over time and 500 different eating disorders, different clients, I've seen 500 different eating disorders. Yeah. It's just not the same. So that was a lesson. That was certainly a really important lesson for me to have learned. And I'm glad I learned it young, because I don't know that it would have been helpful if I became a provider and didn't have that lesson.
Sure. Yeah. And I think it's just kind of a beautiful sentiment in a way to think about, we're all different and unique and we've all had different experiences, but yet we're not alone. Right.
Right. Right.
So
that was huge.
Yeah. Interesting. Did you hear the news about our exciting new offering from the Self-Care Cabaret? We're calling it Talkback. If you're familiar with the theater space, you may have participated in a Talkback before. After a performance, the cast and crew will come back on stage to chat with the audience and answer questions. Think of it as a casual guided discussion. Inspired by this and by popular interest, we've come up with a Talkback for the Self-Care Cabaret podcast. Groups will listen to a podcast episode or two of their choosing, then I'll come and lead your discussion either in person or virtually of those episodes, expanding on the big ideas. It's a great option for groups looking for short, impactful professional development, or smaller teams looking to get an introduction to self-care and well-being. We have done a few of these so far, and let me say, they have been so much fun. So if you're interested in bringing a talkback to your group or organization, email podcast@drmcselfcare.com. And now, on with the show. Beautiful. I mean, I think back to the different behaviors and whatnot and where I am now, and just so different and so freeing and so, I don't know, just it was freeing, the healing, just to not be so obsessed with food and every single calorie and how much I burned and everything. It's just now like it just gave me so much more room in my life to like exist and not like be so to like everything. It was just insane. So
I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. That's
you too.
That is also beautiful here. Thank you.
So I'm wondering, I wanted to, I'm just dying to know, how did the cranky therapist get started? You don't seem cranky at all to me. And your account is
hysterical.
And it's thriving. It's huge. So what's the backstory there?
So funny. I think that I'm from the Northeast, and I don't really hear it in the South very much, but like the word cranky got thrown at me a lot as a kid. And I think it's like a bit of a misnomer. Like, I think when you like grow up socialized as a girl, and like if you give any sort of sass, like you're just kind of viewed as like bratty, bossy, bitchy, cranky. Sure. And I mean, I was definitely, like I had said, I was very precocious and very like neurotic as a child. Like I was like things to be the way they were. Definitely like, okay, like there's a future of mental illness here, clearly. But yeah, so I think like any time, like if something got disrupted or I was like kind of thrown off my routine, I definitely was like pretty unhappy. So I got labeled cranky a lot. And it's just, I think like when I was older, I was trying to reclaim it in a way and give it a different meaning. And I mean, I think there are a lot of ways in which I am cranky, mostly just in that I have a lot of hot takes and opinions that sometimes are just not universally liked, especially just in the world that we live in now. And also, I think just because I am willing to say it sometimes, just in like a way that other people aren't. That isn't to say like there aren't plenty of times where I'm like, I am just going to like go into my hidey hole and like just not deal with this right now. But, you know, I think it's in some way, it's just been a way for me to like reclaim being a like sassy, loud, and opinionated person.
I love it. And it's predominantly or solely a meme account, really, right?
Yeah. So it was an educational account. That was the initial draw, like impetus behind it, was like to be kind of a way to provide free education to people. But as the internet is, it grew to a point where I was receiving so much more negative feedback and just not kind messages and comments. And it didn't feel productive, and it didn't feel like it was filling my cup. In fact, it was like just creating a bit of really a lot of anxiety for me, where it's like I didn't even want to open the app, or like looking at my messages was like a feeling. So I was like, you know what, I'm gonna take a step back and use this account in a way that feels a little bit more fun for me, and hopefully feels fun for other people. And that's the feedback I always get. It's like, oh, like I look forward to this. Like, this is such a great, like, Meme Monday is the best day. I'm like, okay, that's great. That's what I want.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And you had one up recently that was the disco associating. That I'm still laughing about that. That was like a week ago. It cracked me up. And I think it's because my husband will sometimes tell me that I disassociate. And I do. Like, sometimes I just like, I'm a Pisces. I'm a dreamer. Sometimes I just go into my own little head and he'll be talking to me. And I also work in a school. So like, I'm really good at tuning things out. And
right.
He tells it, well, that's what he tells me. So that just like cracked me up. That one, the disco associating, too funny. There's been a lot of them that are just really funny. So very cute. Adds a little levity to the internet, which could use some.
Yes, especially these days. Yeah, I think the world needs a little levity.
Awesome. And I know you have so many like areas that I want to dive into. So I know you've talked a little bit about like your work with folks with eating disorders. And I think I read something that you also have, you know, trauma-informed background and work with a lot of folks with trauma. And I'm wondering how you kind of see that intersection of trauma and eating disorders.
It's a huge intersection. Like it blows my mind, honestly, that like for so much of like, I feel like the eating disorder field has really just been an interesting case study of like, what are we doing? Just in that there, I think even when I was growing up and receiving treatment, there was like a lot of emphasis on like shaming people. Like I just received a lot of like shame-based treatment where it's like, you should do this. And if you don't do this, this means X or Y. And I mean, based on like from other people I know who were in treatment around the same time, it's kind of the same thing. That was just like I'm not sure why, but that was just the lens through which people with eating disorders were conceptualized, where it was like, this is like manipulative behavior. This is like attention seeking, all of that really fun and nice stuff. I think it was viewed as more of a behavioral illness for a really long time. It's like, this is just behaviors, where it's like, I don't really know that I have seen a person with an eating disorder who has not had some form of trauma. And granted, like, I think trauma is also a word that gets thrown around that people don't always understand what it means. Like, trauma can be so many things.
Correct.
So something that's like, there could be something that another person views as like small that is hugely traumatic to another person, especially like a young person. So I think even that, it's like, I don't know that eating disorders really exist without trauma, but I'm always hesitant to say something like that because that seems pretty definitive. But it's definitely a coping mechanism in so many ways. And I think it really helps. I think it really helps mitigate the impact of trauma in a lot of ways, to the point where when people stop engaging in symptoms, it doesn't, like, that doesn't fix the problem. Like, there's so much beneath it. And most of the time, that's why people really struggle to recover, because a lot of treatment is not trauma informed. lot of treatment is not considerate that, yeah, you kind of need to address this, not just the behaviors. Like there's a reason this person engages in these behaviors. Why? Like that's really the root. Like that's really the crux of the thing. So I do spend a lot of time with clients talking about that and trying to normalize also like these behaviors are so functional. There is a reason that they have come to exist. There's a reason why they've continued. And you're not just like making this up for fun. Yeah. Like you're not just doing this to like cause trouble.
Or get attention and, or something like.
Right. And it's amazing how often that is the narrative for people that I'm like the first person that said that to them. Mm. It's heartbreaking in a lot of ways, but I do feel grateful that I get to be that person for people.
We need more cranky therapists around.
there are a lot, thankfully. I feel grateful to be amongst a good pack.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, and it's so twisted up in like so many things. And I do a lot of work in training teachers and educators and helping professionals on how to create like trauma sensitive spaces and like what that looks like. And when I was first putting together this presentation, I had somebody say to me, dead serious. And this is a person like with a doctorate, like someone I considered to be rather intelligent, was like, some people think divorce is traumatic. That's just not true. And I was like, what? I was like, okay. I just smiled at her. I was like, that's like the thing about trauma, right? Though, like you and I could experience the exact same thing, but have very different outcomes. Right. And like, there's so much more complicated than that. And I can't say to somebody that something they experienced wasn't traumatic for them. Like, who am I to say that?
And that, I honestly, that just makes it worse so much of the time. It's like, makes it 10 times worse and harder to heal from. But that's like such an interesting hot take. Like, I think divorce is pretty up there
I agree.
Traumatic incidents. Yeah.
And I was,
especially for kids.
Exactly. But even like my own experience with my parents getting divorced, like, believe me, this relationship was over probably before it even began. Like we're talking decades prior. And I was 19 or 20 when it like officially happened. Like, trust me, that was traumatic for so many reasons.
Yeah. I think it's almost worse I don't know, from my understanding, it's really, really challenging actually for adult children or older children to cope with a parent, like parents divorcing. Like I was 9 when my parents divorced. So like, I don't even really remember them together. So I have that on my, you know, I think that that's actually an asset. Like I didn't really have to mourn them as a couple. Whereas like, I think for people whose parents divorced when they're older, they're not only like mourning maybe some positive experience they had watching their parents be together, but also like just the nonsense that likely got dragged out for so many years.
For sure.
It's like, damn.
Yeah, and there was an abuse component also in my experience. So like there was also, it was rooted in very much in fear and like what's going to happen now and worrying about that. And is my mom going to be safe? Are we going to be safe? And like that, like, yeah, traumatic. Like, so yeah, I mean, it's great if somebody that wasn't their experience, obviously. But I always think of that though when I'm going through like the common causes of trauma. I always think of that and kind of laugh. But anyway.
That's wild. Yeah,
it was a great hot take. But sorry, so one more question. As a therapist, I would imagine you value mental health very much and consider it to be very, very important and probably as important, if not even more important than physical health. And so we know this, right? Why is it so hard, you think, for people to prioritize their mental health?
Oof, that is a really good question.
Throwing some hard ones.
No, I think it's an important question. I think like with physical health as an example, I think our world is really obsessed with physical health. I think there is this just intense emphasis on exercise, food, weight, diet, body, in a way that I think completely takes all of the focus off of mental health. Like there's a lot of eggs thrown into the basket of, well, if you are like this size, have these health markers, you are healthy, clean bill of health. And like, if you go for a physical, they're not really assessing your mental health.
True.
But like physicals are viewed as like, okay, well, this is like the health assessment.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that that is certainly a component of it, where it's like in our world, there's really not a whole lot of room for mental health, because if we actually took time to evaluate and have concern about people's mental health, I think our entire system as it exists would fall apart. I don't think that people would be able to go to work in the same way. I don't think that just so many structures and systems that are in place would continue to be the way they are, which is scary, yeah. You know, to think about. Like, but I don't think that it's just like, I don't think that capitalism would be successful if like people cared about their mental health.
Definitely not. Yeah. I talk about that a lot in my work when I'm even just promoting self-care. Cause I'm like, you know, this is also protective. Like you have to take care of yourself. You have to prioritize your needs. And when you do it in a really, you know, authentic foundational way, like real self-care, not just like mani-pedis and spa days, but like the real stuff, like figuring out how you show up in the world is the best you possible. That like, yeah, it can be a little scary because sometimes you got to set a clear boundary. Sometimes you got to take a mental health day or two or a week or whatever it is. And like, yeah, that's definitely and society doesn't celebrate us for that.
No, they punish us really, and more than anything. Yeah,
absolutely. Interesting. Well, we have more work to do, I guess. That's the takeaway.
Always. There is always more work to do. And I don't know, even though it's like a lot of swimming upstream, it feels distinctly better than just following the current.
Yeah. I think it's just a really good point, though, too, about like when you go to the doctor, like you get the physical stuff, like maybe that's easier to see. And then I always think about the example of like, you know, somebody breaks their leg. What happens? They're in the hospital with a broken leg. They get, you know, flower arrangements and teddy bears and get well cards and well wishes and everybody's, you know, all that. Somebody's in the hospital because of a mental health issue. Is it the same? Do they get the same kind of usually not?
No. No, can confirm. Like even going to treatment as a teen, like I got punished for it. Like I was like just having been in high school and like the teachers were not kind about it. They kind of viewed it as like me trying to get out of school, which is really, really strange because I'm a really good student. I just don't think there's a whole lot of, it's not a whole lot of care about like, oh, like, why would someone even be in the hospital? Like just there's not a whole lot of like conscious thought around like, oh, maybe they're really suffering. Maybe they need some like compassion
and empathy. Yeah, I guess those things like when somebody had this described one time, like somebody breaks their leg or something like that, like that's empathy easy. Like we can see that like leg is broken, bad, like you need help. Like it's easy to give empathy for that. But you somebody else with like mental health issue of some sort, that's not as easy to like to maybe to see. I don't know. Is it the visual component they need? Like, I don't know what it is, but it's not as empathy easy.
Yeah. I like that. I think that's pretty on point. Yeah. Empathy easy.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you so much. I mean, you've given us so much to think about. I want to make sure if you want to repeat like your social media handles or where folks can find you if they're interested in. I know you have a lot of media clips on your website. We'll make sure that's linked, you know, in the episode notes and all that stuff. But if you want to just tell people where to find you.
So you can find me on Instagram at the Cranky Therapist. I post memes 3 days a week, so you'll have lots to laugh at. I don't really use my Twitter all that often, but if you want to find me on there, it's Jess Sprengel LPC.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I very much appreciate it. Keep those memes coming because it's lots of fun and always puts a smile on my face.
Yay.
Thank you again for joining us on the Dr. MC Self-Care Cabaret podcast.
Yay. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you. Jess was delightful to chat with and not cranky at all. She shared so many fabulous tips, and I love how open she was about sharing about her own personal healing journey and the important work they are doing. I love it. What an honor it was to connect with her. And thank you so much for listening. I hope you're feeling more energized and empowered. If you like what you heard here today, subscribe and leave a review for this podcast on your preferred platform. Follow along on Facebook and Instagram at Dr. MC Self Care and Dr. MC's Self Care Cabaret on LinkedIn. You can also visit my website, www.drmcselfcare.com, for the latest updates and to sign up for my cast party, my e-newsletter. And if you're interested in having me present to an audience near you, email info@drmcselfcare.com. Thanks again. Stay well and do good. All right, I made it through without coughing.
Yay!
And I got the thumbs up, so I think we're good.